to Broadway Baby, the podcast taking one casual theater goer to full out fangirl. I'm your host and Broadway Baby at the same time for another minisode, Alex Vasella. And here I'm very excited to present. He's a comedian. He's a musician. He's written a musical of his own. I'm so excited to talk to him. Kevin Froelichs. How you doing, Kevin?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm okay. As good as you can do when we're in New York City's in stage four of the world being on fire. I assume it's good being in stage four.
It's good. It's my favorite stage so far.
Yeah. I don't even know. I honestly thought we were still on stage one. So I was like, wait, two and three? What did no one tell me?
I'm treating it like it's still stage zero, and every person I see I still avoid, and I'm in no hurry to go to bars and pay New York City prices. So that's how I'm living my life.
I think that's a good call. Let's all treat it like stage one at best until we're like, all right, we're done with the stages.
Yeah,
I'm
at the stage.
And then done.
I'm at the stage where now when I go to the grocery store, I don't have a full-on panic attack the entire time I'm in there.
Oh, I think that's technically stage two. So
okay,
that's
good. I'm at stage two.
All right. So have you been listening to any musicals to get you through?
I have. So I have a few that I keep returning to. I've been obsessed with Great Comet for the last several years, like since I first saw it.
I just fell in love with that show. And
oh my God, it's
War
so
and
good.
Peace because of it.
Are you serious? Because I read War and Peace. I read War and Peace a couple years ago because of that show.
Yes, I'm 100 pages in, so it's just like. It's almost got like, and this is going to sound weird, but I think you're the kind of guy that will understand this. It almost has like a Richard Linklater or P.T. Anderson vibe where it's not very plotty in the beginning. It's just about their like snotty internal judgment of each other in this aristocracy. So like no story's really kicked in yet, but like I'm really, everyone dunks on it for being long. No one ever talks about the fact that it's good.
That's honestly... Okay, we're going to talk about War and Peace now for the full podcast. No, because, all right, so like, a friend of mine had told me, like, oh, you would love the show Great Comet. Check it out. And, like, I listened to the, I'm blanking on the guy's name now. Oh, my God. The guy who wrote it.
Oh, Dave Malloy.
Dave Malloy, yes. Oh my God, edit that out where I forgot Dave Malloy's name. I had checked out a couple other Dave Malloy projects that he'd done, like Ghost Quartet. But then I listened to Great Comet, and from like the opening of it, I like fell in love with the show. How they, because I am a fan of like Russian lit in general. Just a fun thing about me. I read Crime and Punishment for fun. I've read other like short Dostoevsky and Nikolai Gogol. Like
do you fuck with the Brothers Karamazov?
I haven't read it yet, but it's going to be the next long Russian book that I usually like. Once a year I read a long Russian book, and this year I read Dead Souls by Gogol. They usually are very dense and a little depressing, so that's why I space them out for my mental health. Karamazov is going to be the next one that I tackle. But like all of those books, there's always like huge families and it's impossible to keep all the names together. And so I was like cackling at the opening number of Great Comet, where it's literally just explaining who the hell is in this show. And I loved it. And then I had a chance to see the show, like it was about to close. And so I was like, I don't care how expensive it is. I got tickets. And they weren't that expensive because the show wasn't doing well because we're stupid and we don't deserve good things. Dear Evan Hansen was getting all the attention, but I went, and Josh Groban wasn't doing a few of the shows. Dave Malloy was filling in, and I was like, I want to see Dave Malloy as Pierre because he originated the role. So I got to see it on stage with Dave Malloy as Pierre, and it was phenomenal. And like I was like weeping at the end of it. And as the soundtrack's great, it's kind of like Hamilton kind of does this too, where you can almost like see the show in your head when you listen to the soundtrack, because so much of the show is included. And Great Comet's also like an opera, essentially. It's all, there's no dialogue and it's sung through the entire way, so the whole show is on the soundtrack. And by the end of it, I was like obsessed with it, and just like I was like, I'm gonna read War and Peace finally. And I think I read it in about 3 months. I had a couple like vacations where all I did was like read on a beach or something in there. And I was like blown away at how readable it was and like how engrossing it was. And honestly, it's like, it's War and Peace. It's about like the Napoleonic Wars. And I'm like, oh, that's going to be exciting. And then it's going to be a bunch of rich people being catty. And the rich people being catty scenes, like that's where the meat is in that. Like the war is kind of like I also, I think I wrote a sketch. Nobody would let me do it, but I wrote a sketch where it was Leo Tolstoy basically writing like diss tracks about Napoleon, because he is just like, there's some great stuff later on where like you read it and it could be written about Trump today, but it's just Tolstoy dunking hard on what an idiot Napoleon was and what like an egomaniac he was. But yeah, I would walk around with a giant paperback copy of War and Peace, and like people would stop me on the train and they'd be like, is that actually any good? Are you just reading that to be like a hipster douche? I'm like, actually, believe it or not, it's really good. And they'd be like, I don't believe you. I had a guy tell me, he's like, there's no way that book is good. I was like, this is one of the best things I've ever read. And I'm also surprised that I'm enjoying it this much.
Yeah, and I feel like there's a moment where everyone who reads War and Peace, every, like, I don't know, 15 pages, you go, I'm reading War and Peace. Like, this thing I thought no one actually, like, I'm doing it. And, like, I'm having a good time.
Yeah.
Like, you're almost baffled that you're literally doing it. Love that show so much. It's the elevator pitch to me of that show is like, hey, do you want to see the Napoleonic Wars portrayed by the Decembrists and also Aphex Twin sometimes?
Oh my God, that's so true. Yeah,
it gets like radio heady like, when it goes electronic.
Yeah, the opera is like this weird, like, Aphex Twin-y sounding thing. Oh my God, the music in that show was just so good. And seeing it live was, because it, like, I wish I had seen it in like the earlier phases where they did it in the round. But they did it, it's the first time I've ever walked into a show and when I saw the set, I literally just like out loud just went, oh fuck, like it blew me away. And like Hamilton, I also was fortunate enough to get to see that, not for cheap, but yeah, like that set was like, the rotating stage was so cool. And like, I walked into Great Comet and just like this, there's like staircases going around everywhere. And like, there's platforms like throughout the theater to like create this immersive experience in a giant theater. It was unreal. They had like on stage seating so that the actors were still like in party scenes, like interacting with the audience like they would have in a smaller venue. So
yeah,
it was such a cool thing to see, and we don't deserve it, and Dear Evan Hansen sucks, and that's where I
love both of them, but I also agree that we don't deserve nice things because Great Comic Club. And also, you know who I really want, just speaking of Hamilton, I cannot pronounce his name to save my life, but his name is Oak. Something.
Oh yeah. He
played Pierre for a minute, and also
and people Danae were furious.
Benton was, yeah, Danae Benton played Natasha. She was my Eliza when I saw Hamilton.
Oh no way.
Yeah. And also I think Mandy Patinkin was supposed to play Pierre for a minute, but that was part of the controversy that Oak
that
got
was,
screwed over.
Yeah.
Which I think, again, that would be pretty cool too, but I would rather see Oak because I'm like, oh, that's a, because I've only seen him basically be Busta Rhymes. I want to see him be a sad guy now.
Right.
Yeah,
that's one of those shows that I loved, and I'm like, I wish more people saw it. And it's another one that's kind of like that is I saw the American Psycho musical, which lasted about half a minute. It lasted like a month and a half. I think it only had like 40 performances, if that. It lasted less than like other famous like flops. Like Amelie famously did terribly when it was here a couple years ago. But American Psycho, it was like everybody I know, like I got to go like a work event. There was like a corporate sponsor was like, hey, we have free tickets to this new show. It's in previews. And I was like, yeah, I'll see it. I liked American Psycho, the book and the movie. And I saw it and it was just so, it was such an interesting show and the music was so cool. And then like a month in, like, you know, the tourist bridge and tunnel crowd, they don't want to see American Psycho. They want to see Aladdin. They want to have a good time and not think about death and the complex idea of morality in human beings. So everybody who saw it and liked it saw it in the first month, and then it just like crashed and burned. But those are two shows that like I always go back to because there's so many great hooks and melodies in it, and I've been revisiting both of those a lot lately.
Yeah, I would love to. I need to give that a listen because it's Duncan Sheik who did Spring Awakening, which I also love. And I was like, well, you know, this could be, maybe it's just a sophomore slump, or maybe we don't deserve nice things.
it's just
Duncan
so heavy.
Sheik probably was thrown for a loop. He's like, but I did this thing, and it's a here, and I do another thing. Okay, I'll go back to singing Barely Breathing. Whatever. So tell me about your theater history. Were you a theater kid? Do you have a theater-oriented family? Like, open up.
I absolutely do not have a theater family, and I was not really a theater kid growing up, I was very shy and afraid of doing anything that would put myself out there. I was involved in like music programs. So like I played clarinet for 11 years all through school and like taught myself other instruments so I could join like jazz band. I played like saxophone and I had like my own like garage bands where I would play woodwind instruments. Very cool. I had a ska band.
Oh, you were doing Jethro Tull shit.
I was. No, honestly, like I was my when I, it was my 15th birthday. My birthday's 4th of July. And so like 4th of July, my family, we would go to like the town field where they would launch the fireworks off. And they would all, it was 4th of July. So they'd have like bands outside and there'd be like ice cream trucks and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, all the like kids would be there. So like all my friends from school would just be there. And like, that was what you did in New Hampshire. It was on 4th of July. You went to the field and you watched fireworks and ate ice cream. And there was like a cover, there was a cover band there and they played the Tull song Living in the Past. And I'd never heard Jethro Tull before, but I was like obsessed with the song. It was like in 5/4 and the guy was playing flute. And my dad was like, oh yeah, that's Jethro Tull. And then like, I raided his Jethro Tull. He had like 2 CDs by them. And I became obsessed with Tull from like age 15 until present day. I saw them at Forest Hill Stadium last September. Like I'm still.
Oh, they're together?
Ian Anderson. Ian Anderson was touring like a 50th anniversary of Jethro Tull. So yeah, I think at this point it's just him and Martin Barre, the guitarist, who are alive and touring. There's a few other like former members that are still alive, but most of them like peeled off and are doing their own thing now. Not related to music, but yeah, so like I taught myself flute because I love Jethro Tull. And then it was like sophomore year of high school where I had friends who were very involved with theater. Like when you're a music kid, at least at my high school, like you knew all the other artsy fartsy people. So like all the theater kids, all the chorus kids, like we all hung out in the same circles. And they were doing Man of La Mancha for the winter musical. And my friend was like, hey, we need guys to be in the show. We don't have enough guys for the show. The theater department was mostly women. And this was, you know, this was the backwards days of the early aughts where you couldn't just do an all female production. Yeah. It's so funny. There's been a lot of things where I realized like, wow, the early 2000s were not as progressive as you would think a year starting with a 2 would be like,
yep.
And just like little things like that have been coming back to me. And we're like, wow, it's kind of messed up that they were concerned about not having enough men in the theater department. But they just needed, somebody to play like, there was I was like, I can't sing. They were like, well, there's a non-singing role called the Duke. And it's basically, if you're familiar with Man of La Mancha, there's Dr. Carrasco is the bad guy in like Don Quixote's dream. You know, Cervantes is like telling the story of Don Quixote and Dr. Carrasco is like the villain in his imaginary fever dream. And then in the prison is where you have Miguel de Cervantes in prison during the Inquisition and all the people in prison are basically playing characters in this play. So I played Dr. Carrasco's counterpart. So I was like the villain of the prison scenes. But basically all I had to do was like, I was like basically a shitty lawyer. And all I had to do, I had 7 lines and all of them had to be like yelled angrily, just furious that Miguel de Cervantes is amongst us. And I mostly agreed to do it because there was a girl in the theater department who I had a big crush on. And I was like, well, this will give me an excuse to spend time with her. But I had 0 scenes with her and literally had no reason to talk to her the entire production. But I did it and I did it. It was like the first time for me growing up, it was like, you know, a chance to like put myself out there. And I really hadn't done that before. So it like helped me personally as like a shy teenager kind of get over some of that stuff. And that kind of paved the way for me in college. Like I started a sketch group with some friends of mine and started like writing and acting in that. And so, you know, if I hadn't have done a show in high school, I probably wouldn't have had the nerve to do that. So it did. And that led to me like starting stand up and doing sketch comedy in New York later. So it was kind of like a first step of that. But other than that, no real theater experience. I mostly just used it to get into, you know, staged sketch comedy and stand up and things like that.
Okay. Speaking of which, so you wrote a musical.
I did.
Great Frontier. Is the full title Great Frontier a poorly researched musical with
about Lewis and Clark? Yeah,
yes.
It's a Great Frontier, a poorly researched musical about Lewis and Clark. It's on YouTube. Just look for Great Frontier musical. The whole thing's on there because how else are people going to see it? But yeah, me and my friend Patrick J. Riley, who's been a writing partner for many, many years. We've done like stand-up together. We hosted a duo show together where we basically did like Abbott and Costello bits. We wrote our own one-man show as a two-person comedy act. And yeah, we thought it would be fun to write a musical together. We had done a while ago, we did like a Halloween theme show where we basically, a bunch of us did Little Shop of Horrors and Rocky Horror Picture Show, where we just did all the songs and then like improvised the lines in between each song. And the whole conceit was like, look, you're not coming to see these for the plot, you're here for the song. So we would just like summarize the show in character and then launch into the songs. And we had so much fun. Like for 3 months, we like put this thing together and we had so much fun and we were like depressed when it was over. So I was like, what if we just wrote a musical? And at the time we started working on it at like the tail end of 2015 and like Hamilton had just started and it was like Hamilton fever was in full swing at the time.
Yeah.
And when we were kind of thinking about like, well, what could we do? Like, should we write it? Should it be meta? Should it be us like writing a musical about ourselves? And it was like, oh, that's a little too title-less showy where it's like two people writing a musical about two people writing a musical. And then I was like, oh, what if we did like kind of like how Hamilton, historical musical, Pat's dad is a history teacher. And like, I read a lot of history just for the fun of it.
Me too.
Which is why I picked up War and Peace and I'm like, this is pretty good. And we were just talking about that. I was like, what if we did Hamilton, like a Hamilton thing where it's a historical show that everybody is kind of familiar with. But unlike Hamilton, we do zero research. And we were like, and then it could be like kind of Mel Brooksy, like how Blazing Saddles did for the Western genre, or just like kind of parody the genre of musicals and, you know, history in general. And then we thought about like the Wright brothers or, you know, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin. And then we kind of landed on Lewis and Clark because everybody already knows the basic framework of that show. They, you know, they start on the East Coast, they work their way west, discover the Pacific Ocean, quote unquote. Thomas Jefferson commissioned them. So we kind of wrote the show around the idea of like, all right, we'll do like a farce, like a Mel Brooks type of farce that's a musical, and we can kind of just follow it as like three act structure. They start on the East Coast, they middle of the country is the actual journey, and then it ends with them making it to the Pacific.
Yeah, I watched some of it and I really liked it, but as a history nerd, it did kind of make my head hurt a little bit because I'm like, wait, why is Thomas Jefferson so chummy with Aaron Burr, the man he put on trial for treason? And he clearly hates James Madison, his closest friend and confidant in real life. Like, it sort of broke my brain a little bit, which I think is another layer of why it's good, because like either you just go, oh, this is funny, or you know the shit and you're like, okay.
Yeah, like I said, Pat's dad is a history teacher, and when we did a first like a live reading of it at Creek in the Cave in 2016, and Pat's parents came, and his dad afterwards came up to us and just gave us notes on everything we got wrong, and like half as a bit and then half just like history teacher fury. Like he felt like he had failed as an educator.
Oh, you sent that man into a crisis.
Oh, yeah.
And it,
yeah, he's like, Kevin, I understand, but Patrick, I raised you better than this.
Why is John Adams so cool?
Why is he arguably so cool?
The biggest dork.
I know, and honestly, I've gone back, like, I've read a lot more, like, American history in the time since, and especially about that era, because I got so obsessed with the real Lewis and Clark, and, like, Meriwether Lewis having, like, serious mental illness, like, which mm-hmm. I knew a little bit of, so, like, in the show, I play Lewis, Pat plays Clark, and, like, I made Lewis, you know, kind of not really mentally ill, but he has like clearly some like depression and like daddy issues, so I kind of, which is way funnier than having a suicidal streak. And then Clark, who was kind of like a real burly man's man and like very much the masculine, you know, adventurer type. And we made him just a very closeted gay man who's just like putting on this facade of the big, tough, strong man. And then eventually just comes out to everybody and everyone's like, yeah, obviously, we all know it's fine.
You're safe here, sweetie. It's fine.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, we've been friends for years. It was obvious. Thank you for finally. I'm happy for you.
Yes. And you also just put out a new album.
I did. Yeah. So that's been an early quarantine project was I was kind of, you know, I was sad that like, you know, I had like my sketch group at UCB, which is no more because of the pandemic shutting down live entertainment, basically, and stand-ups not really happening. And so, yeah, like I said, I was like a music kid all through high school and college. And I still play, like I play a lot of just like guitar, banjo, folk music type stuff now, I tried playing a woodwind recently, and like my mouth muscles are just nothing. I haven't picked it up in like a decade, and so my embouchure is shut. But I was like, I want to get back into music. I've got like mics and recording stuff here, and I was like, I'm just gonna start recording songs for the heck of it. And eventually, like, I was just like writing a bunch of dumb things. Most of them were about quarantine or COVID. The first one I wrote was called Working From Home, and it was like a Springsteen type song where they have to close down the factory, but everybody's cool with it because they can work from home. And I ended up writing
logging into Slack.
I think I had a line in it. It was like assembly line rooms have been replaced by Zoom because you're working from home. So I wrote 10. It's called 10 Songs Too Many. It's on all the Spotify's and Apple Music. It's also on Bandcamp. I've recorded 10 of them. They're all about quarantine or quarantine related things. I recorded them myself in my bedroom. Put them out as an album.
Nice. Yeah. So what's a musical that we have not covered on the show that you're like dying to share with me?
I want to share with you one of my favorite shows that's based on one of my favorite books by one of my favorite authors, and it's called God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, which is a Kurt Vonnegut book. I don't know if you're a Vonnegut fan.
I know I am. I just haven't read any stuff yet. Every time someone like dashes off a quote to me, I'm like, that's fucking hilarious. So I know I will be. I just haven't started yet, but I can feel it, you know?
Yeah. Honestly, yeah. God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater is one of my favorites by him. The one I always recommend to people is Breakfast of Champions. I think it's the funniest one. It's got some like hilarious jokes in it. And Kilgore Trout, the mock Philip K. Dick character, is like the lead in that one. And he's just such a ridiculous, fun character. But God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, it's a very timely show that I believe it was written in like the mid-70s around there. The book came out before that, but the premise is this guy, Elliot Rosewater, is essentially like a trust fund kid. His dad's a senator from Indianapolis, which if you read any Vonnegut book, you'll notice they all take place in Indianapolis. That's his, you know, like Faulkner and all those other guys. He sets everything in like the same place and all the characters keep showing up. But Elliot Rosewater, spoiled rich kid, he's in charge of this like philanthropy group called the Rosewater Foundation. And then one day he has this like, he gets this idea. He's like, I'm going to go to this poor town called Rosewater in the state of Indiana, which is like a suburb of Indianapolis. And I'm just going to give money to the poor people there that need help. And he sets up essentially like a new Rosewater Foundation where people just call him and they're like, I need surgery on my kidneys. And he's like, great, here's money. And they're like, how do I pay you back? He's like, no, I just give you money. And it's kind of like this whole idea of like not hoarding wealth and, you know, closing the wage gap and just like just general ideas of kindness and functioning as a society. And of course, everybody around Elliot Rosewater thinks that he's gone completely insane. The villain of the musical and in the book, it's a very like hands off villain, but it's this lawyer who his whole deal is like he knows that when a vast inheritance is gonna move from one person to another, in this case, Elliot Rosewater Senior or whatever. I think he's a junior. So like from the father to Elliot, the main character, whenever money changes hands, a lawyer has a very good opportunity to just represent someone and get a huge cut of that. And he's just like a real like scumbag lawyer. And he basically uses Elliot's foundation of giving money away as grounds for insanity so that he can't accept the inheritance. And it's just this whole thing of like, why would you ever give money away for free? You must be mentally ill for doing that. So that's the premise of it. The show is amazing, though. It's actually the first collaboration between Alan Menken and Howard Ashman, who would go on to do Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, I love like, Alan Menken.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Every Disney movie.
Disney movie. Yeah. So this was their like first partnership. I do not know the history of like why they picked it. It did not do very well. It lasted a very short amount of time. New York City Center actually just revived it a couple of years ago, and so that's how I got to see it. Pat Riley had actually, he was the one who told me about it after I'd read God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, the book. He was like, oh, there's this Vonnegut musical, and I was like, oh, I've read this book, and the songs are great. They're super catchy. They're super funny, like everything you would expect from those two guys based on everything else they've done, Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, Little Shop, like I said. There's a great, great song in there that's so funny, called Cheese Nips, and it's just Elliot's rich wife. She comes to this poor town, and like they're having a party, and she puts out like caviar and champagne, and all the like very blue collar working class people show up with like cheese nips and Coca-Cola, and she's just like having this like nervous breakdown as like an upper crust 1%er eating snacks like that, and it's so funny. Yeah, the music's fantastic.
Kevin, this was so much fun. So what do you got going on right now? Plug your things.
Yeah, right now, not too much. Things have kind of changed down. Yeah, not dying. That's high on my list. But yeah, right now, kind of just working on some like script projects that I have been avoiding for months and months. And now that I have the time, it's like, all right, I guess I can finally write that pilot script. Working on one now that takes place in Cape Cod, where I grew up, because Cape Cod is just a bunch of boring people wearing boat shoes, and I think that's ripe for comedy. But on the music side, I have started writing some new songs that will maybe come out as a new album, but I'll at least put them out just like as singles. So I'm trying to make them not just more COVID songs, because I got that out of my system. So just working on some new fun ideas there, still in the folk music comedy hybrid genre. And then Pat and I have actually, we just started talking about a new musical, which won't be a historical parody thing. It'll be an original almost Southern Gothic comedy type of story.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, everybody, thanks again for listening. You can find us on Twitter at Broadway Baby Pod. You can get us on Instagram at Broadway Baby Pod. I'm A. Facella on Twitter. Jay is the Jay Schmidt. And Kimberly is at Kimber Coops. Please leave us 5 stars and a nice review. It really helps our numbers. And see you next week.